This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the families of 100 Black people killed by police prepare to journey to New York City for Rise Up October demonstrations. Activists gear up for another battle to beat back the TPP corporate trade deal. And charter schools claim they've improved education in New Orleans, but the facts say otherwise.
But first, Attorney General Loretta Lynch outraged Black activists when she backed off her predecessor's verbal commitment to require that local police send reports to Washington when they kill civilians. Former Attorney General Eric Holder said police failure to keep data on lethal use of force is unacceptable. But his replacement, Loretta Lynch, said she would rather not get involved in such minutiae, as she called it. We spoke with Marsha Coleman Adebayo, an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report and renowned whistleblower who has led demonstrations against the Department of Justice.
When I read the Guardian article, the first idea that popped in my head was, you know, isn't it interesting that less than so many months after Eric Holder has left, we're going to long for the Holder administration to come back? I mean, that really is how horrific her statement is. Under the Eric Holder administration, he had actually recommended, even though there's questions as to whether or not he would have ever implemented it, that police departments are required to report the number of civilian deaths, both armed and unarmed. And the Fraternal Order of Police had come back and basically said, we would also like to have a reporting of how many police are murdered. At that point, Eric Holder said, why not just do both? We'll record the number of civilians that are killed by police, as well as the number of police killed by civilians. Now, this was never implemented, but at least we had an attorney general who felt that there was a need to keep track of the number of citizens that are murdered by police. And so now we have a situation with our new attorney general, Loretta Lynch, who says that she doesn't think it has to be required, that she believes that this should still be, quote unquote, a voluntary activity, that police departments across the country do not have to report how many people they kill. I mean, it's an extraordinary statement, and I guess she considers it bothersome to demand that these police are held accountable and account for the number of people that they kill. I think we have to juxtapose that to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of requirements around people dying in this country. If a soldier is killed in Afghanistan, Vietnam, wherever, the government is required to report to the family that the soldier is missing or killed or injured. And in fact, if a soldier is killed, they send soldiers to actually break the news in person. We don't have anything like that in this country. So Loretta Lynch is saying that, quite frankly, that there's a difference between the way they treat certain segments of this society. If you're just a regular citizen, there's no demand. She doesn't believe that police departments should be required to report the number. But if you're a soldier, she would dare not say that it should be voluntary, whether the government informs the family of a fallen soldier that the soldier died on the battlefield. It's an extraordinary statement, extraordinary.
Yes, she told The Guardian that she didn't want to be reaching down and telling local police departments how they should handle the minutiae of record keeping, as if the death of civilians in police custody is minutiae.
Well, not only that, but it harkens back almost to states' rights, right? You know, where the federal government was saying, you know, I don't want to get involved in what's happening in Mississippi, and I don't want to get involved in what's happening in Alabama. The folks in Mississippi and Alabama will take care of their Negro problem. So it's extraordinary, again, for this political class to be saying that she doesn't want to stoop so low as to tell a local police department or demand that they report to the federal government how many citizens are being murdered by police officers. It really is quite extraordinary. And I think on that basis alone, someone in the Black Caucus or someone in Congress should have called for her to step down.
Especially because Congress this year did pass Congressman Bobby Scott's Death in Custody Reporting Act, which right. does require police departments to make those kinds of reports and does give the Attorney General the option to move towards cutting off funds to those police departments. But that gives a lot of leeway to the Attorney General, and this particular one doesn't seem quite interested in pursuing that kind of pressure against police.
When we have a president who felt that he was too big, that his office would somehow be diminished by going to Ferguson, Missouri, you know, where an unarmed black boy just walking down the street was murdered by police. And as far as I know, I don't think he's gone to any, he didn't go to Baltimore. I mean, you know, so again, this looking down and saying, I don't want to get involved in the inertia part of this process. Let me sort of stay above the fray. It seems to me to be a pattern in this administration that they don't want to hear it. They don't want to see it. They don't want to smell it. They just want it to just disappear. And what we've seen a couple of weeks ago with a young black guy being murdered in a wheelchair, the police are emboldened by the Obama administration's decision just to look the other way while they commit murder and destroy our community and destroy our families.
While this administration, President Obama, the former Attorney General Eric Holder, they are quite eager to take credit for things such as the release pending later this month of 6,000 federal prison inmates who've been convicted, most of them under the infamous 100-to-1 crack cocaine possession laws.
Right. It's again one of those PR stunts that our community should really be quite insulted about. This is a situation where the government has imprisoned, and we don't know how, in terms of that 6,000 number, we don't know how many African Americans, how many whites are going to be released under that program. So it could be 50-50 when we make up the vast majority of the people in prison, which would be unfair, or it could even be worse than that, I suppose. But nevertheless, you know, you're looking at 6,000. Let's assume that all 6,000 are African Americans who were entrapped by this law. We still have another million black people, and I think black men, in prison. So 6,000 is just a drop in the bucket. And I think Obama had a HBO special in which, you know, he's looking sympathetic to these young men who've had their lives stolen by these kind of draconian laws. 6,000 is a drop in the bucket, and I think we should be insulted by that figure. The demand has to be released. Release our brothers and our sons and our brothers and our husbands. Release them now. That has to be the demand. And we don't mean release, you know, a couple here and there. We mean release the men in prison who were incarcerated under these draconian laws, as well as the marijuana laws. We need all these men released immediately, and they should, in fact, receive reparations for the time that they spent in prison. They should be compensated for that time in prison. The reality is that the incarceration is a war against black people, and it's one of the issues that I keep raising in my Black Agenda Report articles, is that when you incarcerate a million people of a certain group, that is an act of war. That is an act of war. And the only reason why we don't see mass incarceration as an act of war is because of this notion that we're all in this together, we're all Americans, and that something went wrong as opposed to the system fulfilling its mission. But on top of all of that, releasing 6,000 people, even if they're all black, is still totally and completely an insult to the black community.
And in fact, the Obama administration went to court to prevent retroactive application of the Fair Sentencing Act, which would have freed the 6,000 shortly after passage of that act 5 years ago.
This is an administration that doesn't hesitate. It never ceases. It is so determined to roll back any ability of people to access just basic human rights. That is just astounding that we still have so many people who are either still pro-Obama or sitting on the fence. Everything from the fact that he thought his position would be somehow tainted by going to Ferguson, to not making statements about Eric Garner, to not going to Cleveland, Ohio, to sit with the mother of a 12-year-old who had been murdered by police. I mean, we have a president who engages in these PR stunts like marching across the Pettus Bridge, but leaving the majority of the people at the other end of the bridge, and they weren't even permitted to march with him because it was solely a PR stunt. And now we have this other situation. Look, I'm happy for the 6,000 who are getting out of prison. No one wants to be in prison, but it's inadequate. It's an insult to our community that they're only releasing 6,000 people. They need to release all the prisoners. They need to release all prisoners who are in jail under these draconian drug laws.
The corporate media and the black political class seem to be going along with the idea that the Obama administration has been a prison reform administration, a criminal justice system reform administration.
Yeah, the system has been able to contract and expand, of course, and that gives the apologists for this system their marching orders. This is another example of that, where the political class in this country has completely failed to tell the truth, to blow the whistle against the kind of heinous activities that are taking place under our name. And the goal of Black Agenda Report and progressive organizations have to be to continue to tell the truth, as difficult as it is sometimes. But that really has to be our mission. And in telling the truth about an administration that has allowed, that continues to allow nearly a million families to suffer and these men to just waste their lives behind bars in order to feed into a private enterprise system that is now built again upon the bodies of the 21st century generation of black people is just so heinous. And the fact that we don't have elected officials and a president willing to tell the truth about this means that every single person in this society has to become a whistleblower. And we all collectively have to blow the whistle on this system.
Well, let's blow the whistle on the black political class. In 1986, when that infamous crack cocaine bill was passed, it got the support of about half of the Congressional Black Caucus, a fact that Michelle Alexander pointed out in her book, The New Jim Crow. What responsibility does that class bear for the 1 million?
It bears an incredible burden, and it means that they're covered in the blood of all these young black men as well. So no one's getting a pass. But it also means that October 22nd, 24th are very important opportunities for people to take to the street and to literally put their bodies in the street to protest mass black incarceration in this country. And so it always comes back, I think, these political issues, these political problems, these political challenges, they all come back to what are we going to do as a group of people, as progressives, as citizens, as human beings? What are we going to do to fight against a system with no moral core, a system that's prepared to incarcerate our children and our husbands and our brothers and our friends and our neighbors? What are we going to do to stop this system that is clearly out of control?
You were talking about the Rise Up October demonstration scheduled for New York. Do you see a slowing of the pace of rebellion that kicked into a higher gear with Ferguson?
It would be impossible not to see that the movement doesn't have the same impetus, energy that it had a year ago. And my fear is that some of that energy is being redirected into the Democratic Party, which it's a place where movements go to die. And so, again, I think it's important for those of us who are still engaged, and I think probably most of the people, even if they're sort of wiggling through the Democratic Party system right now. The question is, you know, how do we begin to educate a new generation about the dangers of going down that road and begin to redirect that energy into a much more productive, progressive direction of helping people understand the contradictions in this society and how those contradictions add up to 1 million black men incarcerated in this country. That's our role, I think, as progressives at this point, is to all become educators, to become whistleblowers, and to become agitators. To agitate, agitate, agitate.
That was Marsha Coleman Adebayo of the Hands Up Coalition, D.C., and Black Agenda Report.
Activists from around the country are gearing up for 3 days of protests in New York City, October 22nd through 24th. The Rise Up October campaign will also bring 100 family members of victims of police violence to Manhattan. Hundreds gathered at Columbia University for a rally last week. Among the speakers, Dr. Cornel West, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
My question for the students here at Columbia University, are you really serious about education? Because education is fundamentally about the formation of your attention. And you tell me what you attend to and I'll tell you who you are. And if you attend to the superficial things of just smartness and dollars rather than wisdom and courage and compassion, it's no accident that we live in an ice age when neoliberal ideology generates a callousness toward the plight of poor people and working people and women and indigenous people and immigrants and black people and Arabs and Muslims and Jews too. And that's been characteristic of the last 45 years of preoccupation with what Wu-Tang Clan says is cream. Cash just rules everything around me, but it doesn't have to rule me. But the market culture, this superficial culture of spectacle that doesn't really want to attend to the things that matter, life, death, joy, sorrow, struggle, contestation, what Du Bois calls strivings. No, we turn away. Why? Out of cowardlessness. Unfortunately, our universities are not sites that generate the cultivation of courage. They generate the cultivation of being smart and successful, and you so easily forget about what you ought to be faithful to, namely something called justice. Don't tell me how smart you are. There were some smart Nazis and smart patriarchs and smart white supremacists. Let the phones be smart, you be wise, you be courageous. That's what Rise Up October is all about. That's what it's all about. It's about a spiritual and moral awakening in a profoundly decadent capitalist civilization in which 1% of the population can have 43% of the wealth, but 1 in 2 children of color born in poverty. Where's the righteous indignation? Where's the holy anger? Where's the moral outrage? Do you think that's normal, that they would be precious children living in the richest nation in the history of the world, dealing with poverty every day? What is going on? Then you got precious black and brown folk shot down like dogs every 28 hours for 10 years, and not one policeman goes to jail on the federal pressure. We did send one to jail in Oakland. That was community pressure over Oscar Brent. But they let him out quick. But then you got black president, black attorney general, black homeland security. That doesn't deliver justice. The police still getting off scot-free. Doesn't translate with those black faces in high places. It doesn't translate to justice for poor and working people. Columbia University, I thought you was committed to the truth, and the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. And if you don't allow the suffering to speak of the folk we talking about, then you're not serious about education.
You're not serious about it. You're playing games. I come from a people who have been terrorized and traumatized and stigmatized for 400 years in the name of democracy and liberty and equality. The level of hypocrisy here we have to be honest about. And I come from a people who've been fundamentally committed to an unapologetic love. Not just a love of truth in the abstract, but a love of concrete peoples, because I am who I am because somebody loved me. I don't know about you. I am who I am because somebody cared about me. I don't know about you. What the Isley Brothers call caravan of love, that's the tradition that I come out of. It's a black freedom tradition. The most hated people in the modern world, and we didn't talk to the world so much about love. Just listen to a little John Coltrane, Love for Friends. Listen to some James Baldwin. Listen to some Audre Lorde. Listen to some Mary Lou Williams. Listen to some Aretha Franklin. Teach you something about love. Brother Martin used to say, justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. And this love business ain't no plaything. Because you all know at Columbia that you have to learn how to die in order to learn how to love and think well. And what needs to be killed in each and every one of us is the callousness and the indifference and the sense of being afraid and intimidated and scared to tell the truth. And when you really love poor and working people, when you really love the sons of our brother Nicholas, then you hate the fact that they're being treated unfairly. You loathe the fact they're being treated unjustly. And if you don't do something, the rocks are going to cry out. That's the tradition that I come from. That's why I overlap with Brother Carl Dix. People say, oh, Brother West, how is it that you travel around the country for almost a decade and go to jail with Carl Dix? You know he's a revolutionary communist. You know he's an atheist. You know he's deeply committed to secular worldviews. I say, yes, I love my brother. Sometimes it's wrong, but I love my brother. Because he's on the same love train, and most importantly, he's willing to put his body on the line and bear witness to what justice is all about. That's what we're talking about these days. We live in the age of Ferguson. What is Ferguson? That marvelous new militancy of the younger generation who, tired of the spiritual malnutrition and moral constipation of contemporary capitalist civilization, they tired of the emptiness of soul, they tired of the stimulation of bodies and instant gratification, they want something deeper, they want something more profound, they want something like joy, not just pleasure, they want something like justice, not just superficiality, they want something that affects poor and working people, not just some colorful set of faces at on high when folk in the basement still being crushed like cockroaches. That's what we're talking about today. That's why October 24th is crucial, because we got to let the powers that be know this talk about police murder and police terror is no fair to fashion. It's a way of life. And we're going to stay at it, and we're going to be faithful unto death, and we're going to die into life. Because as we learn how to die and call into question our cowardice, call into question our indifference, call into question our callousness, we're going to be reborn with new vision, new courage, new determination, new fortitude. But at the same time, and I'm going to end on this note, if love is not at the center of it, it's sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. I don't want to know just how sophisticated your analysis is. I don't want to know how broad your horizons are. I want to know how deep your love is. Because love is fundamentally about a steadfast commitment to the welfare of others, which means you're willing to take a risk. You're willing to bear a burden. You're willing to pay a price for something bigger than you. That's what this younger generation needs. Columbia University, are you ready for this? Are you ready for the rise of October? Are you ready for the love train? Are you ready for the justice train? Are you ready for the equal on the women and the men and the poor and the
Dr. Cornell West is a professor at the Union Theological Seminary. The Columbia University crowd gave huge applause to Noche Diaz, a key organizer with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, who's been repeatedly jailed for protesting police lawlessness.
The moment we're in right now is something I've not seen in my lifetime. I've been in many places over the last year, and I've talked to youth coming up in this world who for the first time have tasted hope. And that is the very thing that has got the authorities running scared. And that is the very thing that they're trying to snuff out and suffocate in the cradle. This is why they've come down harder. This is why they're going after people like me. Because they don't want to see the potential of these youth to come to the stage and come to the fore. They've shown that they can shake the whole world. They have shown that they can wake up whole sections of people who don't face the boot of this. They have shown that they can inspire change, and they have shown that they can represent the ones who are called the worst of the worst, the thugs, the criminals, those who are capable of nothing, showed us that they are capable of tremendous courage in the face of injustice and a tremendous possibility for a whole new world. This is what cannot be snuffed out. So that then when we rise up in October and show the world which side are we on. And the next time, and there will be a next time, until we make a revolution. But the next time these cops come into a community and try to gun one of us down, or break into our homes and drag away our children the way they did at Manhattanville and Grand Homes, just down the block, over 100 people dragged up, facing 20 to life for posting on Facebook. The next time they do that and the youth say, we don't want to take it anymore, they're going to know which side you're on. They're going to know who has their back. They're going to know that when they stand up, they won't stand up alone, and that we can win.
That was Noche Diaz of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
The infamous Trans-Pacific Partnership corporate trade deal has been finalized by the U.S. and 11 other nations, but it can still be stopped by the U.S. Congress. Kevin Zees of Popular Resistance is a key organizer of the opposition.
It's not a done deal. This is just the first stage, and there are many steps ahead. Even before Congress sees it, there are several steps ahead required by the new fast-track law, which slowed down fast-track a little bit. The most important thing is that before Congress starts to consider it, there'll be 60 days where the public is supposed to see it. We'll see what that means in practice, if we'll see the whole 1,200-plus page document, or we'll get a summary or a blacked-out version or what. But we're supposed to have a chance to see it and understand it and mobilize people to oppose it. The politics is looking pretty interesting, actually. Just recently, Hillary Clinton decided to come out against the TPP, something she had called the gold standard of trade negotiations before. Now she's opposed to it.
And this is quite significant because she was Secretary of State during this long process of putting it together.
Right. Exactly. So for her to come out and say she's against it is almost renouncing her work on it. She has in the past dozens of times, I think somebody counted 42 times, where she's pushed the TPP. So for her now to come out against it is very significant. What it shows is the politics of it. Hillary Clinton has a lot of money and is spending a lot of money on polling and focus groups. So she knows which way the political wind is blowing than any elected official or any candidate for office. And what she found was that TPP stands for toxic political poison. And that's something that every politician should think when they see the phrase TPP, toxic political poison. And the reason it's toxic is because the people don't like it. People recognize what happened with NAFTA. They saw the hollowing out of the U.S. economy, the loss of industry, the loss of jobs, the downward spiral in wages, and the massive increase in the trade deficit. And when you see an increase in trade deficit, that means that the economy is being hollowed out. So people are sensibly opposed to the TPP, and Hillary reflects the toxic political poison of this document. And it's interesting in the House of Representatives, which will be the key battleground over whether TPP is ratified, what's happening there. People are realizing now, something we've been saying for almost most of the summer, that John Boehner's resignation has its roots in the TPP. especially the fast-track battle over TPP, where Boehner used his power to twist arms and force Republicans to vote against what they didn't believe in. They didn't believe in the fast-track. They were forced to vote for it. And Boehner did that by he moved about 30 or so Republicans from wanting to vote to oppose it to forcing a vote for it. And then after the vote, after he won, he sought retribution against those Republicans from the populist conservative wing of the party, the Tea Party type wing, to face punishment. He removed them from leadership positions, removed them from rules committee, removed them as chairs of key subcommittees. And people saw this as dictatorial. In fact, there were fightbacks. The blowback to Boehner was so severe, he was forced to reverse some of those punishments, which is really unheard of. And then after they successfully reversed those punishments, the populist conservative Tea Party types decided to seek retribution on Boehner. And for the first time in 100 years, a motion to vacate was filed, to vacate the speaker's office. That had not been done for a long time. And after that, they continued and said they were going to challenge Boehner in his speaker's race. And so Boehner decided to resign rather than fight, and he's leaving. But that means that the next speaker, whoever it is not going to take TPP on as a top priority. They're not going to repeat the mistake and lose their career as Boehner did. So we can see a big increase in Republican opposition, and Republicans oppose it actually for some good reasons that many of us oppose it. It really is undermining sovereignty in the United States. It's undermining democracy in the United States. It's replacing the judicial power created by the Constitution with these trade tribunals that are essentially corporate courts where people can't even sue. It's replacing the legislative power because these courts can rule that you have to change laws. And we saw that during the fast-track debate where a very popular law that required labeling of meat's country of origin was forced to be repealed. And that was repealed while they were voting for fast-track. So the legislative authority of the Constitution created by the Constitution is being weakened. So these conservatives oppose this for all those reasons. And on the Democrat side, similar opposition for those reasons and more. In an election year in particular, when labor is so critical to reelecting Democrats, their work as so-called volunteers going door to door, their funding, paying for political campaigns, same with the big environmental groups. These folks all oppose the TPP. And so Hillary now coming out against it really gives the labor movement, the environmental movement that's alive in the Democratic Party, the freedom to do what they believe in, which is oppose the TPP. So all this is configuring in a positive way. Obama, of course, worked very hard to pass the TPP, both to pass Fast Track and to negotiate the final details. He was calling presidents and prime ministers, trade ministers. He is hands-on wanting this trade agreement badly as his top priority. And that's another reason why, of course, Republicans oppose it. But the reality of Obama is he's becoming a lamer duck every day. We're in the countdown phase of his presidency. How many days left till Obama leaves office? Every day it's one day less. Do Democrats want to kowtow to a president who is leaving office, a president who they've had fights with throughout his two terms? Do they want to focus on supporting the next president, who will be Hillary Clinton or somebody else who opposes the TPP? So I think this is an interesting time. It's going to be a tough fight, and the people are mobilizing. That's one of the great things we saw after the fast track was passed, and then even bigger after TPP was the deal was negotiated. We saw people really wanting to rise up and get active. This would be a bigger campaign against the TPP than there was against fast track. There's going to be more street action. If you want to get involved in that, by the way, you go to flushthetpp.org, and under actions, you'll find it. We're doing a big event in November in Washington, D.C. We hope it's an historic event where people come out and show their anger about this trade agreement that essentially creates corporate nationhood. And we will live with it for the rest of our lives, the next couple of generations, at least, if we don't stop it now. So please go to flushthetpp.org, check out actions, and join us in Washington, D.C. We'll have a weekend of training and art development and planning, and then 3 days of protests. We need people to be part of that.
People don't like TPP because of what they've heard about it, but they haven't heard much because it's been in secret. But now the whole body of the treaty is about to be unveiled.
Yes, we've luckily had a lot of leaks, and so we have a good idea about what's in it. But you're going to hear over the next couple of months, until we start to see the public document, you're going to hear a lot of lies coming from the U.S. Trade Representative, how great it is and how it's going to boost our economy and all this exaggerated nonsense. You'll hear the same from President Obama. It's always important to remember that when the U.S. trade rep claimed that it would create hundreds of thousands of jobs, the Washington Post, a very pro-free trade newspaper, gave him the maximum amount of Pinocchios because it was such a bald-faced lie. TPP will lose us jobs, not create jobs. And even the Washington Post called me on that. So whenever you hear Froman or Obama saying positive things about the TPP, realize you've got to check the facts and not trust the messenger. And the reality that everyone has to understand, TPP stands for toxic political poison. Every candidate, every elected official should stay away from it.
The negotiating teams of the various countries have said okay, but the legislatures, at least those countries that have functioning legislatures, they have to okay the treaty just like in the United States.
Absolutely, and this has already injected itself into other political campaigns. The major issue in the Canadian political campaign is a tight three-way race, and two of the opponents of the Conservative Party, of Stephen Harper, are, you know, calling for a very thorough and public review of the TPP, and it's looking right now like Harper will not be reelected, but he can change that. He's a very effective electoral politician, so it's not going to be easy to remove him, but right now he's behind. You're seeing in Japan, there'll be a vote next year, spring and summer, and that can change the makeup of Japan. Prime Minister Abe, who ran as an opponent of the TPP, became its loudest proponent. He's now very low in the polls, in the 30% area, because of his aiding Washington, D.C. in the military part of the pivot. The TPP is the economic pivot, but the military pivot required Japan to change its laws so it could be involved in warfare against other nations. And Abe passed that, but he did it in a very dictatorial way and with great opposition, and so his popularity has decreased, and they'll be having elections next year as well. And so in multiple countries, there are problems. And so in the multiple countries, there's a strong opposition. And so I think we just have to continue to build our movement and mobilize people, and we can stop this in multiple countries, and especially in the United States.
This argument has the possibility of dominating the election campaign here.
Very good point. And I think that's what Hillary Clinton saw when she decided to come out against it. She didn't want to have this dangling over her campaign for months of indecision, as she has done with so many other issues. She immediately made the decision based on her polling that she should be opposed to this. And that was very smart of her. It'd be interesting if Joe Biden comes in, the vice president, he's talking about running. And if he does, he'll have the TPP anchored around his neck. I suspect there'll be protests at his public events over the TPP, and I suspect that you'll see the TPP destroy his campaign. On the Republican side, you have Donald Trump leading the field, and he's opposed to the TPP. You also have two senators, Marco Rubio and the Texas Senator Cruz, Ted Cruz, who both opposed Fast Track, and that was a sign that they were likely to oppose TPP, and people like Jeb Bush, who will support TPP. So you'll have this debate in the Republican Party as well. And if they were to push as fast as they could right now, the Obama administration would put the TPP right in the middle of the February-March primaries. I don't think it's going to go that fast, but if they did push, that's where it would end up. If they can't go that fast, it gets pushed further back into the electoral season, which I think even makes it more difficult for them to pass it. Our job as a movement is to raise public anger so that this becomes an issue both on the Republican side and the Democratic side. And I know there are people on the Republican side who are organizing like we're doing on the Democrat side to oppose the TPP so that every politician knows that TPP stands for toxic political pollution. Toxic political poison that will destroy their careers, and they need to stay away from it.
That was Kevin Zies of Popular Resistance speaking from Baltimore.
It's widely understood that the TPP treaty is really designed to counter the rising power of China. Joseph Gerson is director of programs for the American Friends Service Committee in New England and author of the book The U.S. Pivot to Asia and the Pacific. Gerson says TPP represents a great wall of China in reverse, a wall to keep China's influence in Asia contained.
Let me give you a couple of quotations from establishment figures, beginning with Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. He said, "In fact, you may not expect to hear this from a Secretary of Defense, but in terms of our rebalance in the broadest sense, Hussein TPP is as important to me as another aircraft carrier. And former Assistant Secretary of Defense Freeman said that TPP is, quote, a bulwark against rising Chinese influence in the Asia-Pacific region. It's about geopolitical influence, not about economics, even butchered economics. So clearly there'll be some economic victors in this, but it's really about trying to, on the one hand, build an alternative economic framework to marginalize China economically, but more in the geopolitical sense, looking to more deeply integrate the societies of 11 Asia-Pacific nations and their economies into that of the United States. You know, at the moment, for example, in Korea, more students are interested in studying in China, where they think their future lies, than in the United States. So this is an effort to try to reorient them away from China and toward the United States. And, of course, losing generations would mean that you begin to lose the military alliances, the foreign military bases, and all the rest that's used to marginalize and threaten China.
Certainly, China was the center of commerce in the world prior to the events of 1492, and it is the center of trade in that region today. How can the United States peel off all of these neighbors of China?
Well, I think my sense is that this is a self-destructive initiative on the part of the United States, you know, kind of growing out of the kind of arrogance of power. The reality is that China, after 150 years of humiliation, is really returning to its historic role, at least in Asia Pacific. And over time, its economy is going to continue to grow. Countries like Japan, I think, will over time find that their interests ultimately lie more with China than the United States. Now, clearly, we want things to be good for our children, and I think we do better to see how we can pursue a common security diplomacy, removal of, by the exclusion of China from the TPP negotiations, just makes matters worse. And the Chinese, in turn, will be pursuing the negotiation of what they call the Chinese Regional Economic Partnership, another free trade area, but one that excludes the United States. And so I think we should be moving to common security negotiations that bring all the parties in, that are transparent, and that meet the interests of all the peoples involved, and address the fears of all the nations involved. This is the foundation that was used to end the Cold War, even before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And this, I think, is how we can build a secure future for ourselves and our children.
How does TPP threaten to intrude upon or interfere with China's Silk Road Initiative, which is designed to knit more closely together the Eurasian economies?
Yeah, well, this is an effort to counter that. And we need to understand that TPP is just one of two major free trade area agreement negotiations that are going on. Another is going on with the European Union. And if both are successful and ratified, and those are two big ifs, they would essentially integrate 70% of the world's gross domestic product, dwarfing what China can pull together. This is the ultimate aim of this agenda. And again, what it means is more confrontation. And to put ourselves in the shoes of Chinese, they understand that this is an act taken to diminish them, and it reinforces their hardliners, not only in terms of economics, but also in terms of the military. And we're already pretty deeply into an arms race with China.
Yes, it's quite common to speak of TPP as part of a trade war, but many fear that it is a prelude to actual war.
Yeah, well, we hope not. And this is where serious and honest discussion and discourse among us is particularly important. You know, we have, if you look at who's running for president, people kind of pursuing jingoist and militarist approaches to the world. And this is not in our interest. I think we have to say that the Chinese have taken a fairly high road in their response to the adoption of TPP, I mean, the completion of the negotiations. An article in People's Daily essentially welcomed it, but if you kind of read between the lines, what they're saying is we don't really believe that all 12 nations are going to ratify this agreement, and we'll see what happens in the future.
Former Secretary of State Clinton says she now opposes TPP, but she explains her objections by addressing the TPP's failure to tackle currency manipulation, which sounds to my ears like a swipe at China.
Yeah, it actually has more to do with Japan. I think Clinton's approach is really kind of opportunistic politics. I mean, as Secretary of State, she launched the U.S. pivot to Asia and the Pacific and helped to initiate the negotiations, or rather to move forward the negotiations of her TPP. But she's running for president in the Democratic Party. I think she's deeply concerned that she hold on to workers' votes, the workers' families' votes, and that dictates coming out against TPP. The issue around the currency manipulation is the fear that by reducing the value of the Japanese yen, it'll make the export of Japanese automobiles cheaper and therefore undercut the jobs of many people in the automotive industry here in the United States. And I think that's how that one plays out.
Depending upon how you measure it, China either is number two or already the world's number one economic power. Certainly, the overwhelming influence in its part of the world. Is this TPP initiative a last gasp of the number one going down to number two?
I don't think we can say it's a last gasp, but it's certainly an important initiative to try to reinforce U.S. power in the region. I mean, if you listen to the debates among our presidential candidates, they're talking about increasing the size of the Navy, which means confrontation with China, especially in the South China Sea. They're talking about reinforcing the nuclear triad. So on the military level as well as the economic, the U.S. lead is pushing to maintain its regional dominance. Of course, this comes at a huge consequence, not only for Chinese, but also for people across the region. Most people here are in the United States are totally unaware of the number of foreign military bases the United States has, about 1,000 of them, and the impacts of these bases on their communities. So you have strong resistance to these bases. They come with crime, sexual harassment, terrible noise pollution. I mean, listeners might think in terms of the sound of the jets as they fly over, say, a football stadium or the World Series. You might imagine that happening over your home many times a day, as it happens in Japan, Korea, and other countries. So this military buildup has an impact long before we actually come to the fighting of a war.
And in many ways, this U.S. pivot has driven China and Russia and the other BRIC nations closer together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people aren't fools, and they look to find ways to reinforce their power and their security. So, for example, when the United States blocked initiatives to give China greater voting rights in the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the Chinese then moved with their Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. The United States tried to keep its allies from joining it, but even Britain joined that bank. And you see increased collaboration between China and Russia. And you see the growth of hardliners as they increase their demands, say, in relationship to the South China Sea. The reality is that, through the Cold War, the geopolitical center of the struggle for world power was the Strait of Hormuz in the Middle East, through which, so much of the oil flowed. Now that is the geopolitical center of world power is actually in the Strait of Hormuz in the South China Sea, because through those waters flows all the oil coming from the Middle East, not all, but almost all the oil, coming from the Middle East to East Asia. China and Japan depend on it. International trade depends on that. And this is where you see the increasing military competition between both the United States and China. Again, we do best to move off the kind of cultural assumptions we have of dominance that apply throughout our culture. The Black Report here is a clear relationship between the threats of military dominance the United States is pursuing in Asia Pacific and in Eastern Europe and the Middle East with the kind of the racial repression and white supremacy and dominance here in the United States.
Yes, and the United States, as you mentioned, is the power that arrays its military hardware in a way that could, in fact, choke off these points that you say are so important to the world's economy.
Yeah, well, the United States is certainly dominant now, but the Chinese have the money now to be building a blue water navy. They've been building missiles that they hope can actually destroy our aircraft carriers. So we're really in, at this point, an arms race. While at the same time, we also have economic interdependence with China. So it's a complicated relationship. But as I look at history, you know, I look back to the years leading up to World War I, when you had increasing economic globalization, great interdependence of the economies of Europe and Russia, the idea that war was unthinkable, the unanticipated happened, almost nobody wanted war, but we had one of the absolute great calamities of the 20th century.
That was Joseph Gerson of the American Friends Service Committee speaking from Boston. The next secretary of the U.S. Department of Education will be a Black and Puerto Rican educator whose entire teaching career has revolved around charter schools. Glenn Ford has this commentary.
Arne Duncan, the outgoing U.S. Secretary of Education, will be succeeded by an even more rabid professional privatizer of public education. John B. King, a Black and Puerto Rican native of Brooklyn, New York, and, like President Obama, a product of Harvard and Columbia universities, has spent his entire teaching career in the charter school business. King is a hitman for school privatization, the perfect credentials to take over from the presidential buddy, Arne Duncan, the ghoul who obscenely declared that the best thing that happened to the education system in New Orleans was Hurricane Katrina. Corporations stand to make hundreds of billions of dollars from privatization of education, so it pays to tell lies about what really happened when Katrina provided the opportunity to illegally fire 7,000 New Orleans teachers, the majority of them Black, replacing them with young, largely white, non-union, and ultimately temporary staff, and then converting all of the city's schools to charters. The privatizers claim that test scores are way up in New Orleans, but studies show that it's all propaganda and phony numbers. Charter schools do what they have always done. They select and retain students that tend to do well on tests and discard the rest. That's called creaming, taking the better performing students right off the top. But in New Orleans, the creaming preceded the charter school coup. One-third of the Black population was driven from the city, never to return. The school children among these displaced Black persons were disproportionately poor, precisely the demographic that does relatively worse on standardized tests. They never showed up for class in New Orleans' newly charterized schools, leaving a much more affluent mass of students to take the standardized tests. But the charter schools continued the creaming of students in an attempt to boost the test numbers, especially at selected schools, all the while claiming that underperforming students were not being displaced. That was a lie. For example, a study by the Education Research Alliance showed that a preparatory high school somehow lost two-thirds of its students when it converted to charter. The school claims it doesn't know where they went, but keeps bragging about how great things are for the kids that remained and for the new students, many of them non-Black. Most of Louisiana's charter schools are located in New Orleans. A study by the Network for Public Education found that the state's charter schools perform significantly worse than conventional public schools. The gap between Louisiana charter schools, meaning mainly New Orleans, and public schools was the biggest in the country, which had a lot to do with Louisiana overall scoring the fourth lowest in the nation. Even by Louisiana standards, New Orleans charter school system flunks, even after controlling for factors of race, class, and qualifications for special education. And the entire nation's education system will also flunk if given over to the lying privatizers like John B. King. But don't expect the Black misleadership class, masquerading as members of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, to save us. Leadership Conference CEO Wade Henderson had effusive praise for Arne Duncan and for his Black and Puerto Rican protege, who will undoubtedly become an even more effective educational evil than his outgoing boss, the obscene Mr. Duncan.
And that's it. for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.